nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
I guess last few days, what you have been discussing, you could call this the semi-classical approach to transport. Now, what do I mean by semi-classical? It's like you have these quantities called density of states. That's like something I stressed right at the beginning of the course, that you want to calculate current or understand the electronic properties of a device. Density of states is a very central concept. And then this other concept that we introduced along the way, that is the density of modes. That is, if you want to know the electron density, then usually what you want is density of states. In the sense that if you look in any energy range and you want to know how many electrons are here in that range, you take the density of states and multiply it by the fraction of those states that's occupied. So that fraction that is occupied at equilibrium would be given by a Fermi function. Out of equilibrium could be any number between 0 and 1. Okay. So density of states multiplied by the occupation, that gives you electron density. On the other hand, when you want current, then rather than density of states, a more useful quantity is this density of modes, which is like density of states times velocity, because the current that's carried depends not only whether you have a state, but what the velocity associated with it is. So that's this thing that we talked about. And you could write, in principle, if you had the positive going states, if the current carried by the positive going states is I plus, you could write it as, you know, when states are occupied, as you know, it's Q over H times the number of modes times delta E, meaning the range of energy that we are talking about. And I put in some quantity here, F, that tells you whether a state is occupied or not. So if that's 1, then the current carried by in that energy range would be given by this. And if that happens to be half, the current would be half as much and so on. So you could define something like this, which tells you the fractional occupation of states and relates it directly to the current. Now, the semi-classical approach to transport, the basic idea is, why is it semi-classical? Well, in the sense that there is some quantum input into it, the quantum input being the density of states and density of modes. Where did that come from? Well, that came from some EK relation usually, which supposedly came from some Schrodinger equation. So that's where the quantum input is. But once you have the density of states and the density of modes, from that point, there's no further quantum mechanics involved. You just think of electrons more or less as particles that are going back and forth among those states. I mean, as I said, that part of the story is not too different from cars going down a highway and just counting how many cars go past per second. That's about it. And what these simply tells you is like how many lanes you have on your highway and things like that. So that's the part that comes from the quantum mechanics. After that, you just think of electrons as particles. And that actually seems to work quite well, that viewpoint. This is what you generally refer to as a semi-classical viewpoint. On the other hand, you think that what would be more correct would be if you didn't think of electrons as particles, but actually thought of electrons as waves and calculated current and all that straight from Schrodinger equation. That is what you think would be more correct. And in principle, that's kind of right, except that, as I tried to explain last day, that when you do calculations purely from Schrodinger equation, taking the wave nature into account, you get all kinds of interference effects, which usually you don't see at room temperature. And when you go down to very low temperatures, you see some of it. That's the point I was trying to make last day. So, for example, when people measure the conductance of a device with lots of impurities in it as a function of, say, the gate voltage, the example I gave in this last homework, you know, where the conductance versus the electron density looked something like this. Thing is, if you looked at low temperatures, you'd have seen lots of wiggles, which are reproducible, so it's not really noise, but it arises from interference, actually. These interference patterns that people do see at lower temperatures. And in very small devices, some of this can actually be important, even at room temperature. So, but it's just that when you're talking of devices that are, say, 10th of a micron long, and as I said, your commercial transistors these days are about that much, 10th or 20th of a micron. And as I've said, it's about 500 atoms or so long, commercial transistors. Then usually at room temperature, you wouldn't quite see all these wiggles. And a lot of the thinking you could do using this semi-classical theory, where you don't worry about wave interference at all. Whereas if you did a full quantum theory, you would end up calculating a lot of these wiggles, which you wouldn't know, which nobody in the would actually measure in the lab, not at room temperature at least. You see? But there are smaller devices where it is important. And even at room temperature, there's some of it you can see. And what I'd like to talk about actually in the next two or three classes is how you'd actually do the quantum mechanical calculation, the one that would actually give you all these wiggles. That's what I want to describe to you a little bit. Now, just to remind you what we are talking about the last two classes, and that has to do with the, I guess, the semi-classical viewpoint, say that the way you think about it is you have got all these states, half of which are carrying current to the right, half are carrying current to the left. And if you look at the I plus, which is what's carrying current to the right, you'd find that from one end, from this end, you have a, you know, this F is 1 at the left end. You're talking about some energy range here. And this much current comes in from one end. But then, as you go down the channel, it gradually goes down. Goes down because electrons keep getting reflected down the way. And we went through this discussion last day, and I think we had an expression something like this, di plus dx equals di minus dx equals minus I, where this lambda is called the mean free path. Or you could turn it around and write it as or plus or minus, either one of them. You could write it something like this, for example. And that's what we discussed last day. Now, one thing that's useful here is, if instead of looking at I plus, we sort of look at the occupation of the levels. So what I mean is, we are talking about this energy range. And if the energy range is completely full, then the current you get is that much. And the reason I plus is less here is because they are less full. So if it, because when electrons come in from here, it's like all the lanes are completely filled, but then gradually they all get reflected. So gradually it's relatively empty. So you could translate this into F, which tells you relatively how full these things are. And so what that would mean is, let me take everything and just divide it by this number, so that I call this 1, and that corresponds to being completely full. That's what came in. And so if I divide it by this quantity, what will this become? I guess 0 will just stay 0. What about this one? What would it be? Lambda over L plus lambda. And what would this be? So what you're now plotting is sort of like F plus and F minus, which tells you fractional occupation divided by that. So what's this one? L over L plus lambda, I think. Yeah, you're right. So you could think of this as the transmission coefficient, that every time an electron comes in, that kind of tells you what's the probability it will get out here without getting reflected. That's a number less than 1. And this you could think of as reflection coefficient, how much gets, what fraction gets turned around. See?
Okay.
So in terms of this then, I could write this equation as minus lambda times, what I'm trying to do is put Q over H M in. So I'm just writing the current as something times df dx. Okay? So nothing much, just that I've written the current as this quantity times f. That's all, nothing much. This is it. Now the reason I wanted to do, I was doing this is that the usual equation, current equation that you see in, say, W305 or 606 is this diffusion equation. And some of you asked me about it, that there is a drift term and a diffusion term usually. And those can often be combined and written as one equation. That is, you know, the way you usually write it is J equals Q mu N E plus Q D D N D X. That's usually the central equation in W305 or 606. But the other form where you can write this in a slightly different form, which I actually like better, and that goes as Q mu n, that's like the sigma, and then df dx, where f is like the quasi-Fermi level. You see? So those two terms can all be combined into one. And this one is actually more fundamental in the sense that usually if I had to prove this, you would kind of start from here. That's really the right way to think. Because the basic point is current flows from one region to another, not because there's more electrons here and less electrons here. It flows because it is fractionally more occupied here than here. So what I mean by that is, supposing you have a box with, say, 100 states here and 10 states here, and say, in a certain energy range, and they're both equally occupied. So what that means is you've got 100 electrons here and 10 electrons here. Would current flow? No. Because these are all fully occupied, these are also all fully occupied, they will be in equilibrium. Current flows if one group is fractionally more occupied than the other. So, for example, if this was 50 and 5, no current would flow either. But if it was 5 and 5, then you might say, well, we got equal numbers of electrons, everything is in equilibrium. Not really, because this is only 1/20th full, this is half full, so electrons would actually flow this way. So in other words, what really drives current is the difference in this fractional occupation. You know, it's sort of like heat. Heat doesn't flow because you got more heat here than there. It's because of temperature. Because temperature, in a way, and this fractional occupation is kind of plays that same role, the role of temperature, in a way, as far as electron flow goes. Anyway, so the point I'm trying to make is that, yeah, current flow really depends on how this fractional occupation, which you often call the quasi-Fermi level, right, which, of course, at equilibrium would be given by that Fermi function, but out of equilibrium could be anything. And of course, current flows because this thing is not the same everywhere. If it were the same everywhere, no current would flow. Okay. So if you compare it with that, you can see this is the quantity then that you should associate with the conductance of a particular energy range, delta E. You know, here, remember, in these small devices, we are just talking of a particular energy range. To actually get the conductivity at large bias, etc., you actually have to integrate over the energy range. And that's when this del F, del E, and all that come in. And we have the actual formulas for that. I'm not going into that. But the point here is that conductivity is really like the product of the number of modes and this mean free path. How many modes do you have and how much scattering do you have? So the longer the mean free path, it means less scattering, and so more the conductivity, etc. So this is all, I'd say, what you'd call the semi-classical theory, the semi-classical way of thinking. And the basic thing about the drift diffusion type of equation, something like this, is that you ignore the difference between this plus and minus. In other words, when you have lots of scattering and a long device, then the thing is, this difference, which I've sort of accentuated, this is almost, you couldn't even see it very clearly. Why is that? Because you see, this is 1 and this is L over L plus lambda. Remember, this is the mean free path. That's like the length of the channel. So if something were, say, 1,000 mean free paths long, then we are really talking of 1,000 divided by 1,001. That's almost 1. So that's like the drift diffusion limit of things, where these two curves look more or less like this. So you don't really have to distinguish between F plus and F minus. And you can say, well, I is equal to sigma df dx. And that then gets you to drift diffusion, standard diffusion, and all that. It's just that in small devices, the thing is, it's really not that close. This difference can be a significant fraction of the overall thing. So if L is 1 mean free path, then you see this comes to about a half. And yeah, this is another half also, etc. Did I say that right? Yeah, if L is a mean free path, yeah, that would be a half. Okay. Now, usually, of course, what you measure is the overall current that flows through the device. And how exactly this fractional occupation changes inside your device is normally not accessible, except that these days people can actually make measurements directly of this using this what's called scanning tunneling microscope, because people have done this on microscopic resistors, you know, where let's say you have some scatterer around here, there's some defect or grain boundary around there, and when they measure the this occupation around it, they find that right around it, it changes. You see, the picture I had before was for a distributed scatterer. You know, lots of scatterers distributed over some length. But if you had just one of them, some localized thing, a grain boundary, people with using scanning probe microscope have actually measured this drop across single scatterers. That you see a certain chemical potential here, and then as you cross, a different quasi-Fermi level, a sudden change that's actually measured. Now, what's interesting is that at low temperatures especially, when they measure it, they even see oscillations in here. And that, of course, is a signature of this interference effects that I was talking about. That is something that wouldn't come from semi-classical equations like this. Yeah. But those are things that have actually been measured and all. So what I'd like to describe to you, like next two or three lectures then, is quantum mechanically, how would you calculate these things so that you'd actually have all these oscillations in there? Right? And that's kind of what the homework 8 would be about, which would be due like the week after Thanksgiving. So, right? Which I'll be posting like next week, so you'll have it. And in any case, the basic equations that are needed to do this, that's what's also the second problem of this current homework. So what I'm trying to do in the next few lectures then is tell you exactly where those equations come from. Okay. So let me write those equations up here anyway, so you know where I'm going, because this will take a few lectures, I mean 2 or 3 lectures, so just so you know where we are headed, and you, yeah, please. Please speak up. Yeah, usually in this discussion, we don't need to bring in a Pauli principle. I'd say that question is whether there will be any net flow or not. And the point is that if both sides have equal fractional occupation, there won't be any net flow. So you could always have electrons going back and forth. Of course, if it's completely full, then that's like, you know, bumper to bumper traffic both ways. There's just nothing moving anywhere, really. On the other hand, if it is like both sides are half full, then there's continually electrons going one way and the other. There's continual exchange between them. But the thing is, there won't be any net flow unless there is a change in the fractional occupation. So 100 states here, 10 states here, only 50 are full, 5 are full. Offhand, you might say that, oh, I got a lot more here, so there should be a lot more traffic from left to right. No. As long as the fractional occupation is the same, there's no net traffic. Net traffic depends on this fractional occupation. Now, the basic equations that we had before, if you remember, let me just write that. That if I had to write the current, say, at the left interface, yeah, you'd write, say, I1 is equal to Q over H bar. And then, and what I'm going to write is the current per unit energy. And it's understood that you have to integrate it over energy to get the total. Okay, rather than fill it up with integrals, I'll just write the current per unit energy. So it's Q over H bar times gamma 1 times F1 minus F, where F1 is the Fermi function in contact, 1, and F is the occupation inside. And then we had I2. Which is Q over H bar gamma 2 times, let's say, F minus F2. That's like the rate at which electrons go out. And then, if you remember, this is, I'm trying to state something we did back in September. So what we then did is we said at steady state, those two have to be equal. And in order for those two to be equal, we could find what F needed to be in terms of F1 and F2. And the expression we came up with was F is equal to gamma 1 F1 gamma 2 F2 over gamma 1 plus gamma 2. This is the whole idea. So this is if you have a single level. Now, if you have a density of states, like a distribution of states, then what you do is you multiply this by the density of states times the energy range. And then you integrate it all over. Right? That's what I said. I'm not writing the integral. But this is what it would be. You'd have a density of states there. So I'll just put the density of states. The understanding is you have to integrate this. Similarly, this tells you the fractional occupation. So if you want the electron density per unit energy, then you could multiply this by density of states. That's kind of like what we had before. Now, and then we got one expression for current by actually taking this F that we had and from here and replacing it back in there. That's how you got one single number, which came out as gamma 1, gamma 2 over gamma 1 plus gamma 2 times F1 minus F2. And again, it's multiplied by D. So let me just write, sorry, I'll write the D over D of it here. This is what we did. And lately, I've usually been writing this equation rather than start from here and say put equal to F and all that stuff. We've been using this more or less. Now, the reason I kind of write this is that what we'll be trying to get at in the next few lectures, two or three lectures actually, is to get the full quantum version of this. Because what I mean is, this is what you could call, again, semi-classical theory in that same spirit. You have got states, electrons come in just like particles, they fill them up, etc. That's the simple picture. What I want to give you is the quantum version of it, which comes from Schrodinger equation, and that's what I'd like to show you in the next few days. So the equations look something like this. In the quantum version, What happens is your device, the basic quantities are, your device is described by something we call the Hamiltonian matrix, right? That we know. And all of October, we have been kind of talking about that matrix and trying to find its eigenvalues and stuff like that. That's the Hamiltonian matrix. Now, the new things we need in order to actually do current flow, yeah, is we need something that describes the connection of this device to the two contacts. And this is where we'll introduce two quantities. Like, just as we had a gamma 1 and gamma 2, here we'll have gamma 1 and gamma 2. Except that, just like H, these are now matrices. So what I mean by that is, let's say this H, you know, it happens to have like 10 atoms in it, and you have got a 10 by 10 matrix. Then these gammas are also 10 by 10 matrices. That's all. That's the thing. That's different. But just like before, I mean, but this physical significance is like what we had before, namely this small gamma 1 and gamma 2. Physical significance is just that. It just tells you how easily electrons get in and out. It's just that it's a matrix to do it right. Actually, it's a little more complicated. What happens is, what you'll see is that you have something called sigma 1 and sigma 2, which are actually complex numbers. So they have a real part and an imaginary part. And it's the imaginary part that works like the gamma. So, you know, all this will be going through slowly. So right now I'm kind of just trying to give you the whole thing in a nutshell so you see where we are headed, right? So I'm not trying to imply that this is all self-evident and you should immediately follow what I'm saying. Okay. So this is the sigma, and the gamma is like the imaginary part of it. I mean, if this was a number, then this would be like the imaginary part. You take a number, subtract its complex conjugate, multiply by I. That would be twice the imaginary part. -2 times the imaginary part. These are matrices. So what you're really finding is what you call the anti-Hermitian part of those matrices. Namely, if this was a Hermitian matrix, this quantity would have been 0. Okay. Similarly, gamma 2 is like the anti-Hermitian. And a basic quantity that we'll be calculating first is something EI H minus sigma 1, sigma 2 inverse. And this quantity, you see, what it is this H is, let's say, a 10 by 10 matrix. This is a 10 by 10 matrix. So 10 by 10 matrix. This is a number, you know, that's like the energy. So for at any given energy, you're calculating this. Now, what's I? It's this identity matrix. What size? 10 by 10. Otherwise, this wouldn't make sense. Right? Every one of them has to be 10 by 10. Now, in terms of these, why is this? This is a very basic quantity that you calculate. And from this G, once you have it, you can calculate density of states, electron density, anything else you want, quantum mechanically. And that will have all this interference information and everything that we talked about. So for example, if you want the density of states, let's say, so then what you do is you look at A, which is like I, G, minus G dagger. Okay. So what's A? I mean, if this is a 10 by 10 matrix, A is also a 10 by 10 matrix for a given value of energy. Now, you say, well, how do I get the density of states out of it? Because density of states means, you know, like we had talked before, at a given energy, how many states we have. How do I get that number? The answer is that this is a matrix. So you look at its diagonal elements and add them all up, and that will give you your total density of states. What's more, it will actually give you some additional information, which is that if you look at this quantity, it will tell you the density of states at that point. If you look at this one, it will tell you the density of states at that point. Here, it will tell you at that point. So what that means is, you know, the reason these matrices are 10 by 10 is because you got, like, say, 10 points in your device. And so this way, you're not only getting the total density of states, but also the density of states at each point. You see? And that's what you call the local density of states. And that is a very important concept in general in terms of nanoscale electronics. And that's because, as I've mentioned before, that what you have discussed so far is the total density of states. That is, in a given energy range, how many states do I have? Well, those states belong to your entire device. On the other hand, what you can do these days is, using a scanning probe microscope, actually come down and measure the density of states, say, around here. Or you could measure it around there, around here. So local density of states at one point, rather than the total density of states. And pictures like this, you know, these atomic scale pictures, which most people would tell you is like one of the most impressive things that's happened in the last 30 years, is that people were able to use scanning probe microscopy to take pictures where you could see individual atoms. This, I believe, is like the surface of silicon atom, and it shows you individual atoms. And the way you do it is, again, you're moving this scanning probe microscope tip along, like at about 2 angstroms above the surface, and you measure how much current you get at different points. So at some points you get more current, at some points you get less current. And then you take that current and turn it into a picture like this, like more current, let's make it blue, less current, make it red. So that's how you get this picture. And why does the current change? Well, the understanding is because the local density of states is varying. You get lots of current when there's lots of states. That's essentially it. So every time you're over an atom, let's say the density of states is low. And if you're between atoms, let's say it's high. I mean, it could go either way, but the point is it will change. And that's why as you move along, you see this picture. So this concept of local density of states, that's a very important thing. And what we have discussed so far, you know, although right from day one I've been stressing the importance of density of states, but that density of states was like about the whole thing usually. And you know, when you find an eigenfunction, it's usually spread out everywhere, a particular eigenvalue, a state. So exactly how do you translate it into a local density of states? And that is those are things we'll be discussing in the next 2 or 3 days. But mechanically, though, as I said, all you have to do is, if you calculate that matrix, calculate that, look at the diagonal elements, it will give you the local density of states at each point. So mechanically, that's it. Question is why and how it works and what it means, etc. Similarly, if you want the electron density, let's say, per unit energy, then there is a quantity you can calculate, which I'll say Gn. And it looks something like this. So this also would be a 10 by 10 matrix. And it's composed of these two terms. The first one is multiplied by the Fermi function in contact 1. The second one is multiplied by the Fermi function in contact 2 at any given energy. Now this is Gn at a given energy. Okay. And so if you are only injecting from the left, let's say in your given energy range F1 is 1 and F2 is 0, then you could be looking at this quantity. If F1 is half, F2 is half, well, you're looking at the sum, half of that, etc. Now here again, just like A, this is also a matrix. It's a 10 by 10. But what you could do is, again, look at the diagonal elements, and basically it will tell you the electron density at that point. And of course, there's a difference between electron density and density of states, as I've often mentioned. that electron density always should be less than the density of states. Because density of states just tells you how many spots are available. Electron density tells you how many of those happen to be filled. Two different things. And how many happen to be filled ought to be always less than what's available. Okay? So this is what you call the spectral function. This is what you call the correlation function. I mean, these are all matrices. But the thing is, if you look at the diagonal elements, the point to remember is this is like density of states. Actually, there's a 2 pi you have to divide by. But other than that, this is the density of state. Similarly, you take these diagonal elements divided by 2 pi, that's the electron density. And if you calculate it this way, then you'd get all those oscillations, interference effects, everything. All that would be there, you see? Now, these equations itself, I guess I've written down most of it anyway. And if you looked at your latest homework, I think I summarized them all here, all there. Like on problem 2, the basic equations are all right there. This is it. Right? And what we'll be going through is how to get these. That's what we'll be discussing. And these are what you would call, see, coherent quantum transport. Coherent in the sense that the assumption is when an electron gets from left to right, it doesn't lose any phase information, and so it gives you all these interference effects. As I've mentioned, often at room temperature, you don't see that much interference effect, really. You get to see a lot less than that, because there's always all this dephasing, which is not in these equations yet. And we won't go into these can be modified a little bit to include dephasing effects, but those we won't go into. Just wanted to give you a feel for how this works. Okay, so now just to get started on where these equations come from, they say the simplest, best is always to start with the simplest problem. So simplest problem is, let's take a device with just one energy level. Device with just one energy level. You know, remember, actually, back in September, that's where we started. One energy level, how do you find the current? Conductance, quantum of conductance, all that stuff. Okay? Now, if you have a device like this, what would be its Hamiltonian? H? Actually, if it's just one level with one eigenvalue, it should be just a 1-by-1 matrix with just epsilon. That's it. So, I mean, you could call it a 1-by-1 matrix, or you could just call it a number, whatever. So that's it. And usually, of course, what we have been doing so far is that we talk about, you know, E, we try to find the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian matrix. What that means is we usually do this E psi minus E psi equals H psi. What that amounts to is you are trying to find this. You're trying to take this EI minus H, psi equals 0. And you say, well, what are the eigenvalues? Which means what are the values of energy for which you can find non-trivial solutions to the Schrodinger equation? That's what we normally do. And in this case, of course, I is just 1-by-1, and the H is just epsilon. So you'd say, what are the solutions to this? When can you find non-trivial solutions to this? Well, when E equals epsilon, so that this is 0. Because if this is not 0, then psi is 0. There's no other solution. That's it. Okay. Now, this is what would describe isolated device with one level. So if you had an isolated device with one level and you put an electron in there, you know, then I guess its energy would have to be epsilon, and the wave function would, and you could get a wave function that's just one, let's say. Now, if you want to get the time, if you want to use the time-dependent version of it, for example, you could have written IH bar d psi dt equals epsilon psi. So So what would be psi? What's psi of t? Can you help me? Exponential, right? So psi, whatever it happens to be at 0, times e to the power minus I epsilon t over h bar. You can try that out. This is easy enough. So if you want the electron density, that's like psi star psi. That tells you. So you take psi star psi and t, and that's how is the psi star psi at time t related to the psi star psi at 0? They are equal. Equal because this is a phase factor. When I take its complex conjugate and multiply it, I get just 1, right? Because it's exponential minus I alpha, say. And when you take its complex conjugate, that's exponential plus I alpha. Multiply, that's get nothing. So what this tells you is that if you have a certain initial wave function, then over time, the magnitude of the wave function is not going to change. Which physically tells me that if I put an electron in here, the wave function will keep having this crazy phase factor in there, but if I look at the number of electrons, it's just 1 for all time. It's an isolated system. If I put an electron there, it just stays there. That's it. You see? But you see, what makes transport problems, or in general all these problems we are interested in, more difficult, is that we don't really have an isolated system. As I've often said, the real whole story basically is I've got this thing where electrons keep coming in and they keep going out, and that's why current flows. So that's what we really need to describe, how electrons come in and go out. And this isn't quite enough. Okay? Now, so first point is how, okay, so the fact that there are electrons coming in from here, we'll get to that in a minute. But for the moment, let's say I'm just trying to describe it so that when I put an electron here, and let's say all these are quite empty. So, you know, the mu 1, mu 2, these are all way down here, so electrons can get out easily, let's say. So my question is, how would I modify Schrodinger equation to describe this process? The fact that when I put an electron in here, in a certain length of time, it goes away. You know, that's what the physical meaning of this gamma 1 and gamma 2 is. That if I put an electron here, how fast does it escape into contact 1? If I put an electron here, how fast does it escape into contact 2? And those you could view as experimental quantities. You know how good the contact is, how long it takes to get out. Good. So what should I do to Schrodinger equation to get that into the story? Now, this is where what I claim is that the following should do it. So I had E minus epsilon. If I add an imaginary quantity here, then what I claim is the solution to this will describe exactly what I want to describe, namely a problem where if I put an electron, it escapes in a certain length of time. Okay. So how do we see that? Well, one way to see it is, you see, whatever we did here, what we have now done is instead of epsilon, we have replaced it with epsilon minus I gamma over 2. By the way, you'll see in a minute why I need the 2. I mean, you might say, well, why did I put in a 2? Couldn't I just call that? You'll see that in a minute. So, in effect, what I've done is instead of epsilon, I put epsilon minus I gamma over 2. So, what does that do to this? What that means is, when I solve the Schrodinger equation, now, of course, instead of epsilon, I got this epsilon minus I gamma over 2. Okay, so here also I need to add another term, e to the power minus I, and then there's this minus I gamma over 2. Right? So, in other words, I had just I epsilon t before. Now, in addition to that, I have this minus I gamma over 2. That's all. Same solution. So what does this come to? Can you help me? You see that minus and minus, that becomes a plus. And then I've got the two i's, so that's a minus, right? So that's what that would be. So what does that tell me about psi star psi? See, I'm supposed to take this, multiply it by its complex conjugate. Remember, that phase factor just goes away. Multiplied by its complex conjugate just goes away. But this one is a real thing there, so that doesn't go away. So when I multiply, I get another e to the power minus gamma over 2. And so overall, it becomes e to the power minus gamma t over h bar. Gamma square.
Yes, or something. Another right. Function of gamma.
Right.
Of course, it would be a function of gamma, but why just gamma?
Right. So the overall justification would be that, let's say, to start with, I have from September, we had this gamma 1, gamma 2, which tell me the rate at which electrons escape into the contact. That's like the lifetime of it, right? Lifetime for the decay into the contact, you could call it. And we could view that as an experimental number, that, you know, with good contacts, it takes a picosecond to escape, let's say. With bad contacts, like in your flash memory, when you put in an electron, it takes milliseconds or hours to escape. Right? If you're really storing it well. On the other hand, your good contacts, they would escape in a nanosecond, picosecond. So that's this number. Okay. Now, what I claim is that this is describing just that now, because now it tells me that the probability decays with time as e to the power minus t over tau. As you know, that's kind of the definition of lifetime, like the radioactive lifetime, right? That's how it decays. That's like the half-life or whatever you call it. So by putting in a quantity like this, I have managed to describe a situation where the electrons escapes with an escape rate of gamma over h bar. That's the argument. And the important thing is that to get gamma over h bar, I need to put gamma over 2 here. Why the 2? Well, that's because the wave function decays with gamma over 2, but that means the probability decays with gamma, which is why the 2. And the other point to note is that I need a plus here. You see, if I had put a minus here, I would be describing something that was growing with time, which is not what I want at all. I mean, that wouldn't correspond to the real situation at all. But by putting the right sign there, I'm getting that.
I heard that in quantum mechanics, the conservation probability with time is a corollary of the time independence of the potential. So here I can see a dependence over time of the probability. What is the form of the potential in this case?
Right. Here also, it looks like the probability is dying, but in an overall sense, though, it is conserved. What I mean by that is the electron's gone from here, but not like it just vanished into nowhere. It goes out into the contact. So that quantum mechanical theorem you're saying is for closed systems. So to apply that theorem, you should think of level plus contact as one big system. And then, of course, nothing is lost. Whatever you're losing here, you're picking up there. But here, there is an apparent loss because we are focused on this. We're trying to.
It's not an open system.
It's an open system. It's not a closed system anymore. Right? So that's the first modification we needed to make. And what we'll do next day, we'll talk a little more about this. The next thing I need to do is put in a source term. Source term meaning that this, again, tells you that left to itself, the wave function will eventually be zero. Why? Because if I put an electron there, sooner or later it will escape, and that's it. In our actual experiment, of course, it's not zero because there's electrons continually coming in. And that coming in, you can put into this equation by putting a psi star psi.
So
sort of a source term there, some source term that tells you that electrons are coming in. And then you can use this equation, which is a modified version of Schrodinger equation, where you've got something that allows electrons to go in and out of the contact, and something else that tells, puts the source term, and that then you can use to describe current flow and all that. Okay? So that's what we'll do next day.